David found a pension that his staff would love. He chose NatWest Cushion because it has a fantastic app that is easy to use. Everyone feels good, except David. He is ecstatic. Take a little more action with a NatWest Cushion workplace pension. Tomorrow begins today. Search NatWest Cushion. Capital at risk.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to The Advisor with Stacey Chalemi. Today, I'm very excited because we have an amazing guest on our show today. She is Shamin, and she is an author. She also is a speaker, a professor, and she is also a TEDx producer. She's done that for a very long time as well. She has an amazing ability of really helping people grow and elevate to the next level and be able to really see the better in themselves. And today she wants to discuss the art of persuasion, including techniques for influencing others and crafting compelling arguments. A lot of the times the people, you know, want to communicate with the people across from them. They just don't know how, you know, because everybody is different. Everybody has their own personality. How do we use assertive communications with others to be able to have a positive negotiation between two people and have it go the way you want it to go? So Shamin, it's a pleasure to meet you today. And I'm thankful that you're on our show today. I'm really grateful that you came on as our guest. I would love for you to tell the audience a little about yourself so people know who you are and learn a little about you.
Wonderful. It's a pleasure to be here. And the audience, thank you so much for having me and being with me on this journey. I'm so excited to talk to you today and to speak with Stacey and learn from her, knowing how amazing her podcasting and interviewing capabilities are. So a little about me, the work I really do is in the area of stoic empathy, which I'll go into in a minute. But I can also give you my life story in a nutshell, which is born across the world in Iran in 77. Y'all, I'm dating myself here, so try not to do the math if you can, please. The Iranian Revolution actually happened in 1979. So I was a toddler when the revolution occurred. In the immediate aftermath of the revolution, there was a war launched between Iran and its neighbor, Iraq. About 1 million people died during that war. There was about 40 million people living in Iran at the time. So that's one out of every 40 people who died during the war. And again, it was in the first decade following the revolution, which was a very bloody time for internal political reasons as well. So I grew up, Stacey, learning how to read the room, learning how to step into a room of people who weren't just different from me, but might have even had hostile intentions toward me or my family. Certainly, if they knew what we were really like, they might feel that way. But here I am, a child, right? And I am maneuvering my way through realness and fakeness on a daily basis, desperately searching for an authentic way of being that was still safe. But what I did learn was how to be a different person in different situations. When I immigrated, I started to truly welcome the expanded ability to be authentic and be myself in all encounters and situations. And yet, as we all know, that empathic awareness of the people around you, right? I grew up to practice law. So whether you're a lawyer or a business person or a parent or an advisor or an RIA or whatever your job is, the ability to be able to read that room and respond in a manner that corresponds with your desire to influence the room is an extraordinary thing that can be very helpful. And to some extent, you can show up as your authentic self while still making sure you're doing it with awareness of the people around you and behaving in a way that would serve you. If it's your job to serve them, then in a way that would also serve them. In the meantime, and so that's the empathy portion that I really focus on. In the meantime, again, having grown up in Iran and learning to sort of keep calm and carry on despite the circumstances, there was up to 6 missile attacks a day into Tehran when I was growing up. It teaches you a sort of stoicism, which was mostly modeled for me by my parents. And stoicism is an ancient philosophy, but really in modern terms, it means emotional regulation. Not only do I want to influence the people around me, but I also want to influence myself. I want to be as in control as I can possibly be over the things that I can control, primarily my feelings, my judgments, my emotions, right? My thoughts. To some extent, my actions, but those are also influenced by my environment and the other people around me. But everything that happens inside, this is much more directly in my control than anything that happens outside. So, how do I combine these two, right? This external influence of the people around me combined with the internal influence of myself to create not just strength, but also relationships that can last a lifetime, that can provide valuable, connect with audiences, right? Of all sorts, whether it's just a one-on-one conversation or you're talking to a camera, or whether you're talking to thousands of people. How do I utilize that energy, that awareness, that understanding, keep what I want controlled within myself? And proceed to behave in a way that would serve me and that would also candidly be in line with my moral code, my integrity, whatever that is. Not my job to tell you what your morality ought to be, right? But whatever it is, I am here to help you be closer to it while still gaining that upper hand in the negotiation and building those relationships in real life.
I love that. There are times where I find that so many people react off their emotions and they let their emotions control the situation instead of taking a step back and really being able to disconnect themselves. Because I would feel that when you're especially in business or if you're speaking in front of a group of people, if you sometimes it's very good because I'm a very empathetic person, but sometimes you have to disconnect your empathy and look at the situation and let your realistic self kind of take control of the situation because you have different personalities that you work with. Everybody responds differently, and you can't, the way you want to react is not always the best way that is going to work well with the person that's sitting across the room or the people sitting across the room. So when it comes to communications, do you disconnect your emotions and do you look at the people you're speaking to? You have an idea of the type of audience you're working with or the person you're working with, and you kind of disconnect your emotions for a moment and you do what you think is best to really make that communication and that moment where you might be negotiating or you might be trying to have people open their eyes to another way of looking at life. How do you work with people? Do you disconnect your emotions
Love
or
that. That's such a great question. And the answer is yes and no, and it also kind of depends. So let me explain. So what a psychologist would tell you is that there's actually two kinds of empathy. There is, on the one hand, emotional empathy, right? Here's emotional empathy, your pain in my heart. It's typically what we associate with empathy. Somebody I love gets hurt, I recoil as if in pain, right? And then on the other hand, we have something called cognitive empathy, and there's a mountain of neuroscience and psychological and neuropsychological research on these two types of empathy. Cognitive empathy is I'm not going to walk a mile in your shoes because it's going to harm me or it's going to harm you, right? But I am going to sync my steps to yours. I am going to smell what you smell and see what you see and feel what you feel. Because the better I understand you and the environment with which you're interfacing, the more I can predict your responses to situations that might arise. So here we have emotional empathy. Here we have cognitive empathy. But really, it's not binary, right? It's actually a spectrum. And unless you are a real psychopath, no, I don't mean this hyperbolically, I mean it actually, it's impossible to be fully cognitively empathic all the time, which is normally if we can shut down entirely, it's because we've shut down our awareness. Normally, if we have some level of awareness, there's a tiny amount of emotional connection there, but it ranges, right? It can be all the way here, like I might be with my child. Or it can be all the way here, like I might be with a hostile counterpart in a negotiation who I'm never going to see again, or my stalker, right, on a personal level. And again, I might be in between for my business partner because I still want to be able to connect with my business partner because I want to have a meaningful long-term relationship, which does require some level of emotional vulnerability. And yet, I don't want to be the way I am with my child, with my business partner. And
Right.
so it's up to you in these situations. And what I do is not judge you for the decisions that you make, but give you the tools to make those decisions and then implement them. In any given context, what level of emotional connection would be appropriate for me? And I maintain awareness no matter what, right? And to the extent I make a mistake, instead of all the negative self-talk that can come for days afterwards, I will instead release what has already happened because I cannot change it. It is in the past. And I will take a different approach next time. And I will continue to practice my stoicism. And the stoicism, the self-control, the self-regulation, that's precisely what helps you engage in this spectrum of emotional connectivity. And the more you practice it, the better you come at it. You know, before she hit record, Stacey and I were chit-chatting about how different we are just because we've got a couple of years on us, you know, mostly me. And just the fact that with age, you gain a certain kind of emotional control and regulation and wisdom. And a lot of that is just practice, right? So what I do in the book, Stoic Empathy, which comes out April 8th, by the way, feel free to pre-order depending on when this podcast comes out or when you're listening to it. You can also hop on and grab it now. In Stoic Empathy, I give a lot of tools, a lot of exercises, a lot of means, not just of judging where you ought to be, but also in figuring out how to be there and then actually implementing the control necessary to be there.
David found a pension that his staff would love. He chose NatWest Cushion because it has a fantastic app that is easy to use. Everyone feels good, except David. He is ecstatic. Take a little more action with a NatWest Cushion Workplace Pension. Tomorrow begins today. Search NatWest Cushion. Capital at risk.
I like that. I like that a lot. And I think that could be actually having stoic empathy and being able to implement that in your daily life and in your work life, it could make you really, I think, have a stronger relationship with your family, friends, and partner. It could actually help you in your work relationship. And it also, I think it could make you a very good mentor or leader as well, because communication is key. We really, a lot of people sometimes have great messages, but the problem is they don't know how to get that message across the right way. And
Yes.
sometimes it's either the body language or if they're unsure of themselves, it will show, it will show in their body language. If speak a certain way, they might be trying to really get a message out, but the way they're saying it or the tone they're using or maybe the words they're using is not resonating with the person across from them or the people across from them. And instead of getting a positive reaction or a negotiation, let's say, if we're going to look at the business aspect, you get the opposite of what you were hoping for. Now,
Oh my
when it
gosh.
comes to really presenting yourself and using all those aspects, what's your opinion when it comes to really getting the words across the proper way, your body language, your tone, using the right words? Because words matter. People don't realize it, but sometimes, the way they say things is they really, they mean one thing, but it comes across as another.
I'm just smiling from ear to ear for those who are listening to this instead of watching it, because Stacey is so spot on, and so few people who are supposed communication experts understand the significance of tone. We do talk about body language, which is great. Body language is what, about 55% of communication? The actual words themselves are what, like 7-8%? You know, it's never precise, it depends on the context. The other 35 something percent is your tone. And you've heard this before. It's not what you said, it's how you said it. You've heard that before, and it has impacted you, and you have felt it before as well. Tone is actually significantly more powerful form of communication than the words you choose themselves. Not as powerful as body language, but in today's world of Zoom and phone calls, and not just deals, but also relationships being forged through Zoom and phone calls, tone takes a much bigger role than it did back in the day when it was a handshake deal, right? And one of the things that's really interesting about this is a business community completely understand the need to understand the opposing side, right? Or the counterpart. You want to buy a company, whether you want to force yourself on that company or whether you want to have a mutual agreed upon merger with a post-merger integration that is going to make all of you rich, you need to research the other side. I mean, it's just basic due diligence, right? You're negotiating against a counterpart, you need to understand them. Why not take that same approach with your clients, with your vendors, with your relationship, with your audience, right? Try to engage in very similar analysis to like a SWOT analysis that you would engage in if you were acquiring a business, right? And but turn it toward your relationship, obviously with different goals depending on the relationship. The goal might be strengthen the relationship. The goal might be increase vulnerability within the relationship. The goal might be something totally different. Up to you to decide. But you're going to use that SWOT analysis in order to understand and evaluate the other side. And that analysis includes their tone and their body language, right? And their words. And it must therefore include a response from you that is corresponding with the strategy you have chosen. So I'm not telling you take an upward inflection or a downward inflection. And this is the upward inflection. My name is Charmaine Cruz. I like chocolate. I teach global transactions, right? And this is the downward inflection. My name is Charmaine Cruz. I like chocolate and I teach global transactions. Very, very different tonality. And that's just one way of changing your tone. But sometimes, in order to be approachable in a situation that others find intimidating, we switch to the upward inflection because it's more welcoming and inviting. We should know that we're compromising some of our power when we do that. That's up to us to make that decision, that sort of emotional jujitsu in any particular setting. I know a lot of people, for example, I know a lot of Brits who take the upward inflection when introducing themselves. Because it just sounds friendlier, more welcoming, and then they quickly switch downward. I know a lot of people that have mastered the warm downward inflection. So it's warm and welcoming while still being powerful and believable and strong. So these are the things, because if you want to convey power, you should be able to do that. If you want to convey welcoming, you should be able to do that. The goal is be authentic and be intentional. Judge what it is you want from this relationship. Make the decision, right? Read them, read yourself, and then be in charge. Be responsible for yourself.
David found a pension that his staff would love. He chose NatWest Cushion because it has a fantastic app that is easy to use. Everyone feels good, except David. He is ecstatic. Take a little more action with a NatWest Cushion Workplace Pension. Tomorrow begins today. Search NatWest Cushion. Capital at risk.
Right. Oh, I love that answer. A lot of times when people speak to others, because everybody is different, every personality is different, but do you feel that sometimes, because some people like to come across as very authoritative. They want to be, want to show that they have authority and they have strength and they're powerful people and they want to come across this way. And then you have people who don't, care for that and they want to just be warm and a more caring, introduction at, when they introduce themselves. Do you find that sometimes taking a step downward really helps the situation because people feel more on your level? And the more you feel comfortable with somebody, the more you're willing to either open up or really listen to what that person has to say, and the respect level goes a little bit higher.
Yes. And what I would say is not only is your comment spot on, I would say it can actually shift, not just day to day or situation to situation, but even moment to moment. You can enter a particular conversation with a particular intention and halfway through realize, oh, we're not on the same page here. And then shift your tone, shift your body language, shift your words, shift your strategy. So that can happen mid-conversation, right? And the spectrum that we talked about earlier about emotional connection, that can also change mid-relationship. For instance, let's say it is with a new client and you don't know the client that well versus a client you've had for 20 years. Think about a first date versus your spouse, right? The level of vulnerability and openness that you might permit in that relationship is going to be completely different depending on what you've built together. And you might have built 20 years of mistrust, in which case you're going to be more guarded probably with the person you're in a relationship with than you might be with somebody you've just met. So it depends on you. It depends on your circumstances. And it's interesting. I know a guy, he's a FBI agent. And this is the empathy tools I teach in the book. So the first half of the book is really about empathy and strategic empathy, how to be strategic. And the second half of the book is really about stoicism and how to insert that control and optimize that strategy. And this guy's an FBI agent, SWAT negotiator, and he's also an interrogator. And a lot of the techniques I talk about are FBI interrogation techniques. And again, it depends. Even if the party's completely hostile, it's the suspect sitting across from you, you might want to choose that you want to have a friendlier, more approachable tone toward them because you want them to feel comfortable so they will give you more information. And something like that could work with your strategy. Again, as long as you step into it intentionally, right? Not because you were too weak to engage in a confrontation, but because in that instance, it made sense to approach them that way. Other times, it might make sense to be a little bit more aggressive. And other times, it might make sense to be a little bit more welcoming, right? And as we move through our lives, we tend to get better and better and better at refining these skills. What the book does is it helps you make that intentional decision as you go along. And then it also explains, from a scientific point of view, from a neuroscience point of view, hey, what exactly is going on in my brain right now when I'm experiencing this emotion? What's going on in my body? What's going on with my heart rate, with my blood pressure, with my pulse rate? How can I better control not just how I express things, but how I feel things inside my body, right? That famous breath you take when you're mad and take a step back. Why do you do that? Why does that pause make a difference? How does it slow down your heart rate, right? How does it work? What other tools are there? Can you give me a few more? How can I habituate myself to discomfort so that I can exist in an uncomfortable space and remain in control for a longer period of time? These are the things I tackle in the book.
Now, do you ever tackle anything where it comes to you're dealing with someone who's stubborn, who only sees things one way, and their square is very small? And I've come across individuals, and you could point something out to them. It could be clear as day, but because they are a stubborn personality, because they don't see it in themselves, and they refuse to really look at it on in an honest way. It might just be their personality. It could be the way they grew up, or it could be because they're in denial because they just don't want to face change. But how do you deal with a person like that? Because I'm sure every single person listening has come across people with personalities like that.
100%. It could also be, Stacey, because it is a core aspect of their morality. For instance, certain aspects of religion can imbue us with an understanding of the world that is a core concept of our morality. And so to approach someone and challenge them on something like that, whether it's because we're engaging in a philosophical debate about religion or whether it's just because we want to get them to go out drinking tonight, whatever the case might be, right? To go and do that, that could feel to the other person to be almost an attack, almost like a spike in their amygdala can occur, like a fight, flight, or freeze response to that attack because a core aspect of their being is challenged. There are certainly ways to do this. And in fact, it's a very normal part of negotiations, right? Normally, when you walk into a negotiation, your counterpart has an idea of where they want this to go. You have a different idea and you want to convince them, right? To think along your lines. And so, again, the best way to do that is to begin by understanding the counterpart, right? And don't limit your understanding to whether closed-minded and stubborn. They are those things. But what is it that they believe? Why is it that they believe it? How does it make them feel? How is it that I could present a counterexample, perhaps through a story? How could I speak with them in a manner that doesn't attack their ideology, but allows them maybe to think they're refining it or taking it to the next step or evolving it, right? Or moving forward with it. What is it that I can say or do to them? And that requires knowledge of them. And one of the things I do in the first half of the book is I tell you how to gain that knowledge. Because the knowledge isn't just through asking questions, although it takes up a section in the book, how to ask the right questions. Especially as a lawyer, I know how you can ask questions that shut people up and how you can ask questions that open people up, right? But also how to control yourself, how to interpret their emotions, how to sort of take the edge off of any negative emotions they're experiencing to bring them down a notch or two and allow greater cognitive flexibility so that you can discover more information, right? How to listen better. I know that sounds really cheesy. Active listening, it's something that we really talk about. The negotiators, the diplomats, the mediators really talk about active listening because they need to go into a situation and sort of leave their presupposed conceptions aside in order to truly listen to what this person is saying. Because no matter how close-minded you think they are, we all, including us, including me, have a paradigm with which we enter a conversation. And that's okay, that we're human beings, right? We're allowed to have a moral code and a paradigm. We want to make sure that we don't allow that to paint a wrong picture of the person we're trying to understand, because it wouldn't serve us. It wouldn't serve us. Yeah.
Now, what was the passion that drew you to write Stoic Empathy? Now, everyone has a reason, especially when we write books, because when we write books, there's usually something that drives us to it. There is a passion. There is something that's meaningful, that's making us want the world to understand this topic better. And there's always a story behind it. What's your story that made you take the next step to really want to make this book a reality and make it so it could be the world could have access to it?
Thank you for that question, Stacey. My story, as I mentioned, really begins as a kid in Iran, learning to read the outside environment. We had multiple interactions with morality guard when morality guards, I should say, when I was little, when our lives were threatened or endangered. And my parents, through their understanding of the guard, of the hostile factor that was in front of us, were able to keep me and my sisters safe. We also had multiple situations where there was massive fear, panic, and anxiety around us. And my parents, through stoicism, were able to assist us in reducing our trauma as much as possible. You can't lie to kids about rockets falling down. They make a noise. So, but you can control that information and relay it in a way that is efficient, useful, purposeful, and serves those more vulnerable than you. As I grew older, I developed a passion for doing the same thing as a leader, doing the same thing as a parent, and doing the same thing as an advisor, right? I need to be able to guide people who maybe don't understand the situation as well as I do, right? Or who are more vulnerable than I am, or whose jobs depend on me, whose health insurance might depend on me, right? Into making the right decision. And again, that doesn't mean I'm dishonest, just like, yes, there you can't lie about the missiles that are hitting the city. But I can deliver the information in a manner that makes it a lot more easy to digest, easy to understand. I can deliver myself in a manner that makes me sound confident and yet humble, right? And this, to me, this art of persuasion, this art of conversation, whether it was in the context of leadership or personal relationships or speaking engagements. I'm a TEDx speaker and I'm passionate about helping my speakers convince a group of people to sh literally shift the way they think about the world. That is the whole point of giving a TEDx talk is, hey, here's a new idea that you hadn't thought about. This is how trees talk to each other using mushroom networks, or kids actually might need more recess than math, or whatever it is that you thought the opposite of 10 minutes ago. I'm going to guide you through story and through gentle transition and imagery and inspiring tales into understanding this paradigm that is my life's work, right? And I'm not going to necessarily do that with everything because I don't understand everything, but this is my field. This is my area. I understand it. And if I approach you in the right way, I can get you there. And I can get you there in a way, Stacey, that helps me sleep at night. I go home at night and I feel comfortable with how I advised people that day. I feel comfortable with what I taught people that day. I feel comfortable with the decisions that I helped people make. And again, there's going to be mistakes. There always is, but you can learn from them and do better the next day. That to me is exhilarating. Being able to do that, particularly because a lot of my talks are corporate talks, and unless a corporation hires me, you're not going to have a lot of access. And then my speakers, TEDx speakers, I've coached 80 different TED and TEDx talks and produced them. But still, I would love to reach a lot more than that and teach them the skill set that they need in order to communicate effectively. And so the book seemed to be a very easy way to communicate that message. And, I got the offer from Hay House, which traditionally has been very, spiritual books and self-help books, but they wanted something for the business section. And I thought, this is perfect. I want to help people, but I also want to make sure that I am not creating the sort of leader that nobody would want to see in the world.
A lot of times when people, they hope to see a mentor or a leader that they could look upon as, as someone that they could look up to, someone that they could look at their behaviors, they could look at their decision making, they could look at how they do things, and they can incorporate some of those tools that they see them using into their own structure so they can grow. Good leaders are good mentors, and it's not always about showing and having to prove yourself, but being able to communicate with other people, no matter what level they're on. Because sometimes what I find too is that when you, especially in the business world, when you get to certain levels and you elevate to certain positions, sometimes people forget about the people below them, or they look at them in a different fashion. And then those people, are upset by that, and the communication actually gets killed because now they're think they're they feel that they're not appreciated. They feel disrespected. They feel that they're doing a very large amount of responsibilities, and they're helping this company maybe function. And if it wasn't for them, they wouldn't be where they are. And then you have people who were once in their spot but no longer in their spot, and they forget these things. And do you feel that, do you ever work with people that are on a higher level to help them really open their eyes so they can realize that no matter where you are in the corporate world, whatever level you're at, that you really need to understand and appreciate the people that are below you, because those people are the people helping you stay where you are. So the communication has to be equal on both ends, and you need to make those people feel appreciated. And then do you maybe teach them skills on how to feel appreciate how these you make these people feel appreciated, different ways of speaking to them, or different maybe methods you to use when they're interacting with these individuals?
Well, I mean, I definitely think that basic respect for everyone by virtue of their humanity is a necessary first step. I would also say, Stacey, the best way that I can put this paradigm in an example or a hypothetical would be a sports team. Think about the different players in a team. They each have a different role. Not every one of them is as famous as the others or capable as the others or as makes as much money as the others, right? Or is desired by as many teams. But without the entire team, you would lose, right? Or at a minimum, you would be more likely to lose. So if you want to maximize the benefits of success for you and you exist in any kind of a structure that involves other people, whether it's a family or a company or a team, I don't really even see it as above or below. Obviously, there's a corporate hierarchy. Obviously, there's always going to be somebody higher than you in that corporate hierarchy. And maybe that person's your client. Maybe that person's your board of directors. Maybe that, you know what I mean? But there's always going to be somebody who's higher, somebody to whom you answer. And I don't know how much that is the point. I think the point is more we need to appreciate and respect our different roles and the different jobs that we have and the different leadership levels that come with those jobs. Because sometimes when we do our best to completely equalize people who exist in our team with us, they misperceive that to mean they have as much leadership choice as we do. That is not what it means. It just means their role is what it is and it's respected, because without that role, we could not succeed as a team. But that doesn't mean that I don't get the final say in this scenario. And I need to make sure that I portray that with confidence, warmth, but also confidence, right? And the knowledge, the inner working that this is my job to make this decision. And by the way, with that comes responsibility. If the
Yes.
decision is a mistake, you need to own up to it. I made
Exactly.
this decision, right? It was
Yes.
not the right decision, right?
Right.
And
Yes.
so, and it's okay. Like, no one's perfect. You're going to make mistakes, but the reality is what you want to do is you want to approach people as equal human beings, but you also need to understand their role in the organization is not necessarily equal to yours, right? They have a different role, just as meaningful. Without them, you couldn't succeed, right?
Yes.
Or at least you would have a significantly lower likelihood of success, right? And so, how do you optimize those interactions and still keep them professional and keep, especially in a work setting, right? And make sure that in going out of your way to make people comfortable, you don't inadvertently make them uncomfortable. And that's become a really tricky issue in the modern era. I mean, things are so different now from how they were when I was growing up, but my number one rule would be keep it professional and keep treating people like they're human beings that deserve dignity and respect. And
Yes.
it's okay to be mindful of the fact that you have a different role than they do, and you're going to
Exactly.
implement that role differently. And
Yeah.
they might disagree with you, and that's okay.
It's
And
okay.
it's okay. It's still your job to make that ultimate final decision, even if you grabbed everyone else's input or didn't. And then it's your job to take responsibility for the decision. And it's your job to know what it is different members of the team can offer you in your decision-making process. Still
Yeah.
your decision. But that doesn't mean they can't offer you insight that you didn't have otherwise.
Yes. I feel like, one of the things that you mentioned that was really, really struck me is that when you look at it down to it, it's really about taking down the ego level. Because like when I worked in the corporate and media, it was very the world, a lot of people had a very high ego. But if we take that ego down and we become more humble, and we actually learn how to respect others, the respect and just being humble and just being appreciative towards each other could go a very long way and can make that communication between each other a very strong communication where no matter what level you're on, each person could actually help the other person and you can grow in many ways. And even if you have one objective goal or many, many goals that you'd like to achieve, by treating each other as an equal and by being able to clearly communicate yourself with the right tone and with the right words, you could actually develop a very good relationship with lots of people that could actually, in the long run, help each other and get to the point in where they're hoping to be.
100%. I couldn't agree with you more. That is so important. It's also, honestly, just a nice way to live your life. You know what I
Yes.
mean? It's a good way to make your way through your life. What I would say about the ego is actually a significant aspect of Stoicism is about releasing ego.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean you release power. And those two things are very different, right?
Yes.
And in fact, if you're already the leader, you already have the power, right? You don't want to pretend that you don't just to make people feel more comfortable, but you also don't need to go out of your way to assert its existence, right? Just to make people uncomfortable. And so the reality is that power and ego are not the same thing. You can
No.
maintain your power. Sometimes you can strengthen your power immensely by releasing your ego. It's up
Yeah.
to you to decide in that situation. What is the best move for me? What will serve me and my team and the people I'm responsible for the most in this situation? And
Yeah.
sometimes that means turn around and walk away. And
Right.
sometimes it means stay and confront. Either way, neither of those decisions should have anything to do with ego,
Right.
right? Release that, let it go. It's useless to you.
100%. I agree totally with you. Now, if we had to take today's conversation, you really wanted to really pull out a few things that to emphasize to the listeners that you feel are important. What are some things that you really like to emphasize to the listeners today?
What I would say is if you want to move, interact, interface with persuasive communication skills, step one is always awareness of the room, of the people around you, the people you are addressing. Step two, although really they're both the same step, is your awareness of yourself and your
Right.
ability to be able to exert control over your thoughts, feelings, and judgments, right? And with greater practice, both of those things become easier. I do offer lots of tools, including tools with scientific backing, to help you get there. And at the end of the day, what it really takes is a being accustomed to the discomfort of feeling uncomfortable and existing in that space and making sure that you are able to make wise, rational decisions, both about yourself and about others, and with respect to others in those different situations. And then also remember, there's a difference between what you're feeling and how you're expressing your feeling. What you
Yes.
want is you want to seek alignment between those two. So this is what we were talking about earlier with tone and body language. So
Yes.
make sure your tone and your body language are in alignment with what it is you actually want to say. Because I have definitely heard, hey, it's not what you said, it's how you said it. But I also heard that sometimes and I thought, why? How did I say it? You
Yeah.
know, and I didn't know. I really thought, how did I say? I didn't mean to say because I said it thoughtlessly, right? Or without intention. I wasn't paying attention to my tone.
Right.
So now I'm going to do that a little bit differently and approach that situation differently. And it is also something I will practice, just like my exposure to discomfort, just like my body language, and just like my words.
I love it. That's excellent tips for our listeners. And I just have one question for you. We had talked earlier before the show. We have a lot of listeners on our show that are professionals who are very interested in the speaking world. And because you are an expert when it comes to TEDx talks and helping others improve their abilities to have amazing TEDx talks, what would you suggest to people who want to improve their speaking skills? Or in one day, maybe become a speaker on a TEDx, or want to be able to go onto a stage and really grasp the audience and really have them, indulge in what they have to say. Like, what are your a few tips that can really help improve or tweak someone's skills to help them get above the level they're at the
Oh
current moment?
gosh, well, I could talk about that for days, but I'll give you a handful of real quick tips. And just to paint some picture, I've produced a lot of TEDx talks, but I've also produced some TED talks because TED produces about, half of their talks themselves, and then the other half of the TED talks, not TEDx talks, they pull from the TEDx producers that they like. And so that's an entirely global stage. What I
Yeah.
would say is, again, know your audience. So for instance, if you're approaching a TED audience, it's not a keynote. It's a very, very different speech. They're not necessarily interested in you or your life story. They're interested in the idea you have to share with them. And you need to, in order to make that idea something that is palatable, approachable, interesting, and in order to make yourself seem like the relevant authority on that idea, put the idea in terms of your story, right? So that you're presenting it as and yourself as the authority on that idea, but it's about the idea. It's not about you at all. A keynote can be completely different, right? A keynote can just be, hey, I'm here for 20 minutes to tell you about my success story. And it's a really interesting success story, and I hope this inspires you today. Every once in a while, people give TEDx talks like that as well. I will tell you, nobody sees those. I mean, you might get, I think I had two of my talks were top 100 TEDx talks globally produced last year, another two the year before out of every 10 that I make. And they all get thousands and thousands of views. The average TEDx talk only gets a few hundred. less than 1,000, right? So what you want, if you're giving a message, if you're delivering it on a TEDx stage, which by the way is a volunteer stage, we're not allowed to pay our speakers, we're not allowed to take money from our speakers. So if you're on that stage, you're doing it to make a difference. You're doing it to make an impact. You're doing it because this is the culmination of your life's work, and you have ideas that you want to share with the world. This is your chance. And what I would say is, if you can take some of that into your keynotes as well, it converts a keynote from just a success story, which interesting and great, and I'm sure it's a big reason why they asked you to come and speak on that stage, but it converts it into a life-altering moment for that audience, where they leave not just inspired by your story, but having learned to look at the world in a different way. Whatever aspect of the world it is, whether it's how trees talk to each other or how children learn, right? They see the world in a different way than they did before your talk. So that's the first step. The second step would be make sure you practice your body language. I'm going to give you two real quick tips just because we are together and I feel like I should, because you said members of your audience are interested in this. Please, please, please don't do this on the stage. This thing, okay? If you're listening to this and you can't see me, I'm gently rocking myself back and forth. People do this when they're nervous. People also do this to soothe their babies to sleep. The whole idea is you're rocking yourself because it soothes your nervous system. Please do not do that if you're addressing an audience of any kind, whether it's a jury, a courtroom, opposing counsel, a client, or a group of 10,000 TEDx audience members, because it comes across as uncertain, because you are revealing the very anxiety that is within you in that moment. And while anxiety can be extremely helpful in helping you prepare, and if revealed, can be charming and make you seem more human and vulnerable, you certainly don't want to sound uncertain when you're trying to change the way people think about something. It is not, it's not going to serve you. Okay. So that's one thing that I would absolutely recommend. The other sort of body language tip I would give is your hands. Nobody ever knows what to do with their hands. It's not strange that you don't know what to do with your hands. It's very awkward, these things that are in front of you and you don't really know what to do with them. If you don't know what to do with your hands, just resort to putting them by your side. That's it. Not in front of you, not behind you, not gentlemen in your pockets, please. We don't want to see anything bulging out of that area of your pants. Okay. So just put them at your side. Why? Because now there's nothing blocking you from your audience. There's no arm or purse or podium or handbag or coffee cup or piece of paper separating you from your audience. And you are more open. And that's exactly why it's uncomfortable, by the way. You are more open and more vulnerable with them, and they can connect with you, which is really what you want. You want them to have empathy for you. You want them to connect with you. And the more open you are to them, the more you can accomplish that. So if you don't know what to do with your hands, leave them by your side. If you do enjoy expressing yourself with your hands, go ahead. Be yourself. Be your authentic self. Just make sure the hands aren't providing a means of separating you from your audience, but rather providing a means of explaining your points and painting the picture, right? So those are two tips for body language. A quick tip for tone: you want to fluctuate. Please, please fluctuate. A monotone, "Hello, my name is Charmaine Cruz. I have some really great things to tell you," right? Is boring. They're asleep before they even started listening to you. Fluctuate your tone, fluctuate your volume. One second, you want to dip down, and the next second, you want to go up, because it helps indicate to your audience when they should be paying attention, right? The next thing you want to do is you want to take a breath from time to time, especially when you've just delivered a gut punch point to your audience, right? Whether it's a client you're giving some news to, or again, a room full of TEDx speakers, you need to give them a second. This material is second nature to you. You get it. You understand it. You've been prepping for it, right? This is the first time they're hearing it. So give them a second to process that information. Not a long time, right? You don't want to create an uncomfortable silence, but you do want to give them that beat, right? For it to sink in. If you just made a joke, if you asked a question, give them the beat. You want them to actually start thinking of potential answers in their brain before you answer it for them, right? And so those would be my tips for that. And then in terms of words, just remember, it's more about the idea than about you, but you are the ambassador. You do need to establish authority. And the best way to communicate ideas, the best way is through stories. You can do it through pictures. People do a lot of PowerPoint presentations these days, which helps them communicate their ideas. That's great. Stories are better. If you can combine stories with pictures, that's even better. But as long as you're not putting anything between you and your audience, that includes a laptop. It includes a podium. It's more important for them to be making eye contact with you and feeling your warmth and energy than for you to have a perfectly crafted PowerPoint presentation in the background.
Oh, I love those tips. Those are amazing tips. Thank you so much. No, really. Those are you hit a lot of topics that people, you see a lot of people do, and they're common mistakes. And a lot of times it's because they're on stage, they're a little nervous, and they don't even realize sometimes that they're doing these things. But with practice, you're just like everything else. People have to realize to become a good speaker, it's just like everything else we do in life. The more we practice, the better we become. And so by using those tips and actually practice it at home, maybe recording yourself,
Record
maybe.
yourself every time. Every time. It's horrifying to watch those record because you know what? You're not good until you are. So when you first start recording your practices, you're terrible. And that's okay. Accept the fact that you're terrible. It's part of the process, right? Still do the recording. Don't be too embarrassed of yourself to do the recording. You don't need to show it to anyone else if you don't want to, although it's always advisable if you do.
Exactly. I remember when I first started speaking, I would record myself as I practiced, and I'd be like, "Oh my God,
Oh
oh
God, I know. It's like when we were younger and we would hear our voice on the answering machine and we would say, "Holy cow, do I sound like that?" I don't know if young people can relate to that nowadays, but
I can
yes, you
really."
do. You sound like that.
It. Oh my goodness. Now, your book is in pre-launch, correct? Right
Correct.
now?
It gets released April 8th. It's a thing that publishers do. The second Tuesday of the month is when they release books for some reason. So April 8th, and hopefully, and again, I don't know when this show goes live, but whether it's before or after, it should be everywhere. Amazon, Target, Barnes and Noble, your favorite bookstore, wherever it is you consume books. If they don't have it, ask for it. They'll get it for you.
Wonderful. That's amazing. And where can people find you?
So, Stacey, as you know, I have this very difficult to say and spell name. So, I decided to make my website my difficult to spell and say name because that was a good marketing technique on my part. But hey, at least it's authentic. It's www.sharmeencruz.com. I'm sure Stacey will have a link in the podcast notes. So, again, that's www.sharmeencruz.com. I will also tell you all you have to do is Google stoic empathy, and I will come up. And you'll find ways to reach me. I'm also on LinkedIn, by the way. It takes me a while to respond to all the messages, but I do eventually get to every single one on LinkedIn.
I love it. And before we go, can you just tell people what type of services you provide so they can, if they need you, they could find you on your website, your authentic website that has a very special www.
100%, 100%. I am a speaker. I don't provide coaching services, not to individuals, but I am a speaker. The speaking coaching that I have done has been in the TEDx context, but I'm now just a corporate speaker and I teach law. And I don't know if that's going to serve your audience very much, but hey, if you guys got a question about global transactions, feel free to shoot it my way. And I write. So please read my material, interface with my work. That is really the best way to get to know me and get my advice and my opinion on things.
Oh, I love it. Well, this has been a wonderful podcast. I really enjoyed everything you had to say. Your advice was through the roof. You gave such great advice. I'm so glad you're writing this book because I think a lot of people have trouble with communication, and communication is key in so many aspects of our life, in all aspects of our lives, actually. So, everything you talked about today could actually apply to all areas of our lives. And I think sometimes we need to really stop and think before we talk sometimes and take a deep breath, and think about who we're looking at, who they are, what type of personality are we dealing with, and what's the best way to approach the situation. And just like we were talking about, practice makes perfect. Well, if you're not good at reading people, learn how to read others and maybe even take a few minutes to get to know the person, because that could tell, a lot of people, they just jump into a situation. I think, you were mentioning too, like we could do research on the person before we meet the person, get a feel of what type of person that is. You can nowadays you can find out a person's life story. What are their interests? What do they like? And you kind of get an idea of who we're dealing with, and be able to use all the tools and the strategies you mentioned today with their personalities. Knowing their personalities could actually get along. Get you a long way, and as you mentioned before, a little humbleness wouldn't hurt, and maybe dropping that ego down a little bit and just showing each other respect could go a long way too.
Love
But
it, love it.
you are wonderful, and thank you so much for being on the show and all the great advice that you provided today. I really appreciate you, and I thank you so much for being on our show.
Oh, the pleasure was entirely mine, and I'd say my favorite part was making Stacy laugh. That was my favorite part. Check mark in the plus column.
Well, you have a great day. Thank you
Thank
so
you
much.
as well.